remarkably challenging music. I wish to express my appreciation for it. One is often assigned an occasion to speak at the various congregations, and things may happen in between. Prior to the time of such an event, for example, I was asked to speak to this congregation, but certain things have happened that I would like to present today that I might not have thought of presenting if this had not been this particular weekend. I draw to your attention that Ezra Taft Benson, the president of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, died this past weekend. Many will remember him in the administration of President Eisenhower. Many were not born then. He was in the Department of Agriculture, a person of significant contribution in his own right. It was only so many years ago, in January 1986, that many people from different groups, religious and otherwise, in various religions around the world, paid their respects to the former Pastor General Herbert W. Armstrong. And so sometimes it does pay us to reflect on the lives of prominent people whose general contribution has been far out of keeping with the way many behave in society. 2 weeks ago, this morning, there was the death of John Henry Widener, whom my wife and I have known since 1958. The Seventh-day Adventist elder. He and his wife had been in our home. We were in his. I would like to tell you a little bit about the opportunities we had last Sabbath, 1 week after the death of John Henry Widener. You will remember that on Monday, nearly 2 weeks ago, his face appeared on the cover of the local newspaper, the Star News, which was in fact taken Friday, the day before he died. His heart failed. He was 81, would have been 82 this year. He was born October 22 in 1912. In Brussels, Belgium, Dutch citizen, when I first met him, it sometimes was easier to converse either in French or German. I don't know Dutch, modern Dutch, as it was to converse with him in English, which was his fourth language. Some of the brethren knew him from that time till now, and I want to express my public appreciation that at the memorial services where we met Mrs. John Widener, one of our members here, Mr. John Hopkinson, and his daughter were able also to be there and pay respects. Mr. Widener told us something that will be the basis of my sermon, which I will point up at the moment and then tell you a little bit more of the things you should know of his life. He once asked me in our home, "Who is the head of your church?" He did not. He knew me better than, let's say, he might have known our administration. I told him Jesus Christ was the head of the church. No. He said, "I mean, who is the head of the church?" The one who really administers things in the church. As a Seventh-day Adventist elder, that was a logical question. I said, "Jesus Christ is the head of the church." Now, John Widener had been interrogated by the French and German secret police, And he was quite aware of answers that people gave. And when one recognized that he knew me for what I was, he believed me. He did not think I was trying to avoid an answer. And instantly he grasped something. This has never been in print in any of the material written about him, but I think it tells you a lot. Having understood that I had given the correct answer, he defined the nature of our church government. Just with the one statement that I had made, Jesus Christ is the head of the church. He said, "Why then, your church government is based on faith." And you know, I had never really sat down to contemplate what it was based on in terms of our thinking. Now, we recognize that the Bible gives us illustrations and makes the statement which I had repeated. But if I had repeated that, that led to two questions. One, did I believe it? And two, if I believed it, how do I live in response to that belief? For there are some who some time ago now concluded that Christ had in fact failed his responsibility to be the head of the church, and has been allowing things that must not be allowed. And so some left with that premise. But if Christ is the head of the church, I must take a different view. It was remarkable, especially for those who are, as I am, in the 60s or older, to have the presence of a person who had spent his time in Europe. And I would like to tell you a little bit about it, because Mr. Tkach wishes us to reflect next Monday on what is called D-Day, June 6th in 1944, that took 11 months thereafter to win the war in Europe, which ended early in May in 1945, the following year. John Widener was a person who lived his adult life at such a critical period. A book was written, published, if I may just turn to it here, by the Southern Publishing Association in Nashville, Tennessee, called Flee the Captor by Herbert Ford, with a foreword by Wissert Hooft and another individual. That is an Adventist publishing house. Herbert Ford is an Adventist by background and a writer. It was my privilege, in particular, my wife didn't always stay where I was because Mr. Widener had a food store, and he would ask me sometimes to come back to a little table and a chair in his back room, where I was introduced to Herbert Ford, and he would be reading aloud to John Widener what he had written based on the tapes that Mr. Widener had made. And John Widener regularly had to correct what was said. One, it either might not have been clearly understood, or as any writer does, we tend to have to fill in a certain detail in order to have the story move, even though the original person telling it didn't fill in that detail, and it turns out that such a detail may not have been correct. So it was a remarkable experience to be in the background, let's say, of a book that came to tell such a story, and to meet the author and, in a sense, to be with the autobiographer as well as the biographer. The description of John Widener was given in the Los Angeles Times, May the 23rd, as it was also in our local paper, and that is available if you want to check in the library, if you did not see it or did not take note. I would like to tell you a few things about his life, just as Mr. Tkach could tell you some of his experiences by knowing the men who've made the difference, the possibility for this work to have done what it has done in recent decades, which certainly would not have been the same if the events of 1944 had not occurred 50 years ago. One of the things mentioned, not in the book, but at the occasion, the memorial service for John Henry Widener, was the fact that he tried to steer young people whom he found were unemployed. He gave opportunities normally to people who were immigrants into the country. And I met one of the young men that he tried to help and had a chance to speak to him briefly on more than one occasion. And at the memorial service, it caused quite a ripple when the young man's name was mentioned whom John Widener tried to help. I can tell you that it was true. His name was Sirhan Sirhan, who was responsible for the death of Senator Robert Kennedy. John Widener was honored by a number of individuals whose names I think would tell you a lot about what some people have done who've rescued, as he did, with the help of many others, some 900 to 1,000 people, mainly Jews, Allied airmen, or people of major prominence in the diplomatic scene. There were those whom I have already mentioned, Herbert Ford. There was the Consul General Peters of the Consul General's Office, the Netherlands, the Consul of Belgium, Celestino. There was a child in the resistance, Mrs. Breyer. There were Mr. and Mrs. Ben Cornelis. He was a rescuer in the Dutch Paris resistance, and she was one of those who was rescued. The attorney and president-elect of the Temple Beth El at Riverside, Attorney Goldware. The French, the Belgian, the Netherlands, the British were represented by a written message. The civic leader and treasurer of the city of Monterey Park, Mrs. Louise Davis. Some of these things will tell you to what extent a man's life has a great deal of effect, far beyond the areas where he may have done his work as he did in Europe. In this book, Flee the Captor, I would like to tell you a little bit about what can happen that we sometimes don't think can happen in our lifetime or to us. But it may pay us to think about the problems that do beset a society in critical times. There were people who often in the early 1940s, after the Germans moved into the Low Countries in France, who blundered in their efforts and gave life for life. But their unpolished acts shine bright in the annals of man as one's own brother's keeper. There was a little widow who passed her Aryan identification card to a Jewish mother, who in turn let the Jewish mother take her card with her little child, and the person with the Aryan identification card marched off to the firing squad meant for the Jewess. Life for life. The cattle dealer who was hanged in the public square for concealing 35 Jews. And to go on, there were people who offered their lives for another. But that really doesn't solve a problem in the sense of who is going to stop the killing. There must be something greater in planning. And it is remarkable that one of the most distinguished achievements in wartime France was accomplished by Dutch Paris. That is, it was the Dutch who were living in Paris and in France who were the first and primary people who organized a route ultimately from various areas of France, Holland and Belgium also, to the area of southern France then under the Vichy government, because Vichy was the center of government. And John Widener was the mainspring and founder of this group, a people who risked their lives, who decided what we all would learn in wartime. As the son of an Adventist minister, one does not rescue only Adventists. One rescues people who are not even Christian. One rescues Jews or anyone else who has the need of help. One discovers when in prison that there are gypsies there. There are Jews there. There are Catholic priests there. There are Marxists there, communists. There are homosexuals there, each being there for a specific reason, what he is. You do not go around saying, if you are not one of mine, I cannot help you. You are not my brother. You learn what it is like when people with all sorts of differences or problems are put in a situation where their life is at stake. John Widener did what he did, and many others assisted, because he could travel back and forth in what is called the underground. The underground works above ground. They do not work in tunnels and holes under the earth. Now, I shouldn't have to say it, but somehow we tend to think in those terms if we don't clarify it to ourselves. The underground may be riding the train with German soldiers as you travel in public, maybe meeting in a park where you can see who is around you, maybe driving along the border with Switzerland. John Widener did not normally operate along the Spanish border, though Dutch Paris used both areas. John Widener could not have done his work if he hadn't been trained unexpectedly in his academic career. Coulonges on the French-Swiss border. In fact, he knew the border region in a way that almost no Frenchman would have. And certainly the Germans didn't. If he had not been schooled there, he would never have known how to climb up and down the Alpine mountains that he was able to use. He was in Paris when the war broke out, sought to leave France, and was detained in the city of Lyon in the south. And he could not leave France, and then was in the business pertaining to the marketing of cloth. He was a businessman and trained, and he was also trained in biblical studies. There were a number of lessons that one learns when I read the book and heard some of his story. I wanted to take a bit of time to tell you what can happen in life. I will start with a short episode later than the first one for its shock value. On a day that John Widener was at the train station in Lyon, he recalled that he had recently been confronted with the reality of the war in a most shocking and maddening way. Herbert Ford is writing as a biographer. Waiting for a train that day with many others on the station platform because he used the train wherever possible to transport people who were escaping. One walked with an escapee, or one sat nearby, but never with an escapee. You always attempted, as the one who aided, you attempted to sit as close to some German officer as you could, or somebody in the military of the occupying power. The closer you were, the obviously more innocent you would be. Or do you understand the reasoning? And so the Germans never suspected him when he used that technique. Waiting for the train, he saw a group of Jewish women who had been arrested and were being deported. One of them carried a fretful baby in her arms, and despite everything she could do, the child continued to cry. Nearby stood a Nazi officer who personified the worst that war could offer. He ordered the mother to keep the child quiet, but there was no way of stopping the cries of the baby, as some of you mothers know, and or fathers. In anger, the Nazi snatched the child out of the mother's arms, slammed it on the concrete platform, brought his heel boot on the baby's head, and the child was dead. I won't read the reaction of the mother to you today, but you can understand what it's like. There are those who gave their lives helping others. There are those who were able to plan cautiously enough so that lives did not have to be given and the work could go on. There were those who had to operate with passports, with identity papers that were fictitious, as John Widener did. He used to ask himself the question, he told me as well, as it's discussed in the book. Should he or should he not have false identity papers? Should he always use the identity of who he was? Because surely, if it was known who he was, his business would be over, and anything he could do to help others was gone. He was troubled by that. But when giving a lecture on such a crisis at the Fuller's Theological Seminary, very thoughtful of them to have invited him, one of the young men for the ministry asked him, John Widener, how could you possibly have allowed yourself to live lies when a Christian is supposed to tell the truth? In answer, my words, the principle is essentially the same, John Widener said, I had to ask myself, what would God say if I had allowed all these people to be killed when I had the responsibility to rescue them? He said, I owe to God the responsibility not to have these people killed, not to be a murderer in his eyes. I did not owe to Adolf Hitler to tell him the truth. Hitler, of course, is the person who stood behind what was being done, as far as man can see. But John Widener had these papers that enabled him to get about. I would like to tell you a little story here out of the book. Many of you have not read it. I should at some time. I have a copy here with the dust jacket, and that would not be the one I want to leave. I want to leave one without a dust jacket, or the jacket becomes dust when too many have it. But I would like it to be available to this congregation, if some of you have not read it before. A living person who paid respect to our church members who, when they came to his store, said, I know who your members are. I can tell right away. As distinct from others, even of our own congregation. And he said it respectfully. He said, your people love one another. He was a very observant man. And I hope that is still true today. In an account here, John Widener was involved in a situation, the background of which is not always essential for the story. You are John Henry Widener? Yes. We are the Gestapo. You will come with us. A very German expression. You will come with us. There are questions you must answer. But what have I done? You will come with us. Now, get your coat. It had been that simple. They had come to his apartment in Lyon and told him he was under arrest. The charge? Well, there was really no charge, the plainclothes Gestapo officer said. They were simply questions he needed to answer. That was reason enough for arrest in southern France. So they had gone, John and the officers, to the Gestapo headquarters in Lyon. There, the time-consuming ritual began. Now remember, no charges. Sometimes they didn't even know who they were arresting. Sometimes they did. John Widener was fingerprinted, pictures were made, many of them. Then his life story was taken. Where were you born, Widener? How long have you been in France? What is your religion? What is your business here? What are your political feelings? The questions seemed endless. The strain increased as the hours dragged by. Now, Widener, we are most interested in the nature of your activities in the past few months. It is known that you are helping your people, the Dutch, in their illegal movements, and that you have given them assistance. We are interested in hearing your story about these activities. I have helped some people, John conceded as he sat bored looking. There are many here in southern France who are without income and they're starving. I've always tried to help people in need. You have been giving assistance to to your Dutch consulate here in Lyon. Why is this? Can't the consulate itself help without your assistance? Well, certain work of the consulate in helping Dutchmen in France has been made more difficult through many new government regulations, John replied in a steady voice. I've been asked to give some assistance to our people by the consul, Monsieur Jacquet, merely as an easier way for the consulate to render its legal services. Then the German uses a typical word, translated blockhead. Do you expect me to believe such stupid talk? You have been giving illegal aid to Jews. There were Dutch Jews. And your consulate has also been giving such aid. I can only tell you the truth, John continued. Mr. Jacquet will tell you the truth also. He's a good and honorable man. We will see about that. We shall know quickly all about the activities in which you have been engaged. Now, we're also interested in your relationship with, and then there are a conversation over a particular person, which I will not discuss here. He happens to have been a Dutch Jew. And then they named a number of others. These names, which I will not read here. Do you recognize any of them, Mr. Widener? I have not heard or known any of those people. Ah, now you were trying to cooperate with us, aren't you, Mr. Widener? The officer smiled. To every question you give a negative answer or a smart one. All you have told is lies, and that's too bad for you. You will soon be very sorry. About 20 minutes later, other officers came in, and the whole questioning began over again for psychological reasons. The questioning went on into the night, John sticking to his story that he had done nothing against the Germans, only that he gave help to those in need. Finally, the Gestapo officer ordered Widener taken to the torture room. He was stripped, his hands tied behind his back, and thrown into a tub filled with water. The guard shoved John's head underwater and held it against the bottom until he began to drown. Then his head was jerked out of the water. Now, blockhead, will you answer our questions? No. John said as he gasped for air. The guard slammed Widener's head under the water again, jerking it up just as he was about to drown. The group in Paris, you know about them? No, gasped Widener. Now he could have said yes. And then they would have known who he really was in terms of its relationship. A third time his head was pushed under the water and he began to lose consciousness. He alternated between prayer and discipline of mind and refused to let himself tell anything about his organization. 1 hour, 2 hours, 3. Finally, he was pulled from the tub and half dragged to another area of the torture chamber. He was kicked about by the officers. Remember what happened on another occasion all night and into the morning? Recorded in 4 Gospels. Several times he tried to stand, but was kicked down. He was slapped, kicked, beaten in a senseless demonstration. There is something you will enjoy very much, Mr. Widener, designed to make your legs more comfortable. Kneel down, the guards said, and on the floor where he was to kneel was a large steel ruler set on edge. As Widener's knees came down on the floor, the steel rulers pressed deeply into both legs, just below the knees. The pain was excruciating. There, doesn't that feel comfortable? That is the comfort we give people like you, who will not give information we want. We have other comforts that you will enjoy too, if you live long enough to get to them. That will give you some feeling of what it was like to have to go through to rescue hundreds of people, up to 1,000. Some remarkable cases. I can tell you one without reading, but those details were a little more personal. Upon jumping from a train on one occasion, even a man like John Widener can make a mistake. He was near the Swiss border and found the border and crossed the barbed wire entanglement and met two soldiers and explained his case, who he was, whom he was to meet, where he had come from, and was asking the two German Swiss guards to take him into town in order that he might complete his responsibility. And as the two officers led him to the compound, John suddenly caught the fact that above the compound where they were taking him to was the Nazi flag of the Third Reich. He had only crossed the first barbed wire entanglement. And he asked himself, how foolish could one be to have assumed the Germans did not have two or three before you get to the border? He was taken back and was on a train headed to Germany, and in fact had entered Germany. And on the train were many other people who were going to a slave labor camp. Having learned a lesson there, he needed to realize he must have his wits about him. They were no longer in France, and when they got into Germany, everybody who was being taken to the slave labor camp stayed on the train, and the German guards went off to eat. Now, John Widener could have sat there with everybody else, but when the German guards had just gone around the corner, he walked off the train too, carefully not to be seen by them, and then proceeded to buy some food because he knew German, and to dine in a restaurant, which clearly nobody in an underground would do, especially in Germany. It never had occurred to any of the others to leave the train. Many of them would not have been able to hide their identity because they may never have spoken the language. But Widener was a trained professional person where one knows at least two other languages beside one's own. He walked to the Rhine River, and being an athlete, he was able to swim the Rhine even though the Germans aimed their machine guns at him and the river was strong. In fact, he essentially didn't make it except for the fact that when He was completely exhausted and put his feet down. He realized he had reached the muddy side of the other side of the river, the Swiss, and had in fact escaped. The morning, early, early morning of the day that he was to be assassinated, because the French secret police had in fact resolved the responsibility that they had and turned him over to the Germans in France, he jumped from the third story in America, which Europeans call the second story, because there are two stories above the ground floor, and the ground floor is not number one. He was remarkably athletic and did not break any of his bones. And when he jumped from the train, he had not broken any of his bones, though on one occasion he had been knocked unconscious because he jumped from the train as it was going around a corner proceeding to Germany. He was arrested four different occasions. It was my privilege to talk to him on one occasion in his store when he said he was going to be honored by the Jewish community, and I had the privilege of being there in the 1960s when that honor was given, and the Jews had asked him to speak. And necessarily it was the logical thing there to speak about the importance of the law and of that which says you shall do no murder, the commandments. His speech was very well presented. When he needed to, he rose above the limitations of his fourth language. It was last year, in April, that he was also honored, I think it was in Arcadia, by the Jewish community, whose representative was also there at the time of the memorial service last weekend, this afternoon, a week ago. I mention these things because we often are so far removed, unless one has been in Vietnam, but this was different. World War II had many kinds of heroes and heroines of different religious conviction. And one learns in a crisis like this what it means to be a brother's keeper, as you remember from the original story of Cain and Abel. John Widener understood the importance of grasping church government. He saw it as a matter of faith. I would like to expound on that a little this afternoon, because it would tell a great deal about why most all of you are here. Some of you might simply be guests and would not normally be in attendance. Or why you were here and others who had been here no longer are. There was a Bible study in which my wife and I were privileged to be participants after the services in one of the Southern California congregations. And usually in a study like that, there's a question and we give an answer. I concluded without a question, except to pose one to myself. It was this: how would I explain to God why I had done what I had done if I had decided, and I was speaking to the deacons and elders and their wives, to leave all of you and to participate in a competitive work? What explanation could I have ever given Jesus Christ to have abandoned my responsibility in the church and all of you? It meant something. This was the first time, and everybody clapped because they realized that is really the issue in government. To know who is the head of the church. Paul, the apostle, to the Hellenists, the Greek-speaking peoples, Jews in the Hellenic world, Greeks in the Hellenic world, was not the head of the church. Jesus Christ is the head of the church. Peter was not the head of the church, even though there were some later who came to the idea that the Lamb of God, Jesus Christ, had returned to heavenly pastures and had given his responsibility to Peter as the shepherd. That idea rose much later. The reality is that none of the apostles were the head of the church, nor were any of their successors, however you may construe the word successor. Jesus Christ is the head of the church. That is the way it is established. You could go back in the days of Moses. Moses was not the head of the church or the congregation of Israel. The Lord, the Eternal, was the head of the church, that congregation. Church is a word coming from another language, had the same general sense that congregation originally had in the Hebrew, and we take one usually in Old Testament terminology and the other in New Testament terminology. There were those who thought Moses was the head of the church. And Moses made some mistakes. In fact, he made very many. He made so many because he kept following that cloud, taking them in the wrong direction. Once he got to the promised land, Moses told them after the testimony that was brought back by 10 of the 12 who searched the land, that they were not going to enter. So in a sense, some of these people said, we're going to enter anyway. That's what we were supposed to do. And any leader of the church who can't see what we were supposed to do is not fit to be the leader. So the Lord and Moses and those who were willing to stay with the Lord left the borders of the promised land. And others decided to take responsibility in their own hands. The story of government, beginning with the days of Moses to the time of Jesus the Messiah, the Christ, is a very interesting story in this context, because the same thing can be said of the government of God over the New Testament church. You remember, however interpreted this may be, because there can be different ways of looking at the symbolism, there are seven lampstands, separate lampstands in the New Testament. Revelation 2 and 3. As there was one lampstand with seven branches, because there was one nation and one area where that government was ultimately to be established. So there is a distinction in the nature of the organizations that the government of God supervises in the New Testament, both in terms of the people who are fundamental to each period, the geography, and the nature of continuity, which is not the primary subject. But looking at the Old Testament, there were indeed some very interesting and critical periods of time that I would just like to bring to your attention. Moses could be criticized. No man is perfect. Moses was certainly not. Moses led the children of Israel to the borders of the Promised Land. Joshua took them in the Promised Land. And the elders that outlived Joshua represented the conclusion of a remarkable period in which the congregation of Israel was organized as a congregation or church, and if you please, as a state, with a constitution, the Torah, with a government in which there is a king. There is a king over Israel in the days of Moses. Now, if you think I have confused myself with the story of Saul, you should read the story of Saul. Because in Saul's story, it is quite clear, as God told Samuel the prophet, you may indeed anoint Saul as king. Don't feel, God said to Samuel, that the people have rejected you. You understand they have rejected me from being king over them. So in fact, the one who was ultimately in charge of Israel, who was, if you please, the head of the congregation, was God as king. And the people didn't see it. They only saw human government. And they could see mistakes that might be made from time to time. Very often they couldn't see their own. But a remarkable thing happened. No sooner had the children of Israel buried the last of the elders that had the experience in the wilderness who outlived Joshua, that we find the nation doing good and evil in a remarkable sequence in which there is no visible government, in which there is a visible government under a judge, a man, or in one case, a woman. And then again, no visible government. This is the period that we often call the Judges. Quite distinct from the events in which God was in a very personal way operating through Moses, through Joshua, and those elders that outlived Joshua. Then you had this remarkable period of leaders and then no leader who was visible. Now you might say, this certainly isn't the way things should be, and there undoubtedly were people like that based on what you hear from time to time if you read that one remarkable book called the Book of Judges. A book to test any generation's soul. There are people who could have raised questions about God's management, his government. Why sometimes he chose no one as judge? Now the answers, of course, lie clearly in the book. When the children of Israel did evil, God gave them no new leader under him. They had to learn to come to a repentant state of mind. Whereas in the days of Moses, God established Joshua. There was no interim. The predecessor anointed the successor. But now things were different. You would have to ask yourself, what would be your view of a God who lets the government
run as you find described in the book of Judges. Well, it came to the place that the people wanted a king who would have an heir, so they would always have somebody they could look to as the ultimate leader. For in reality, most of the people hadn't even thought of God as responsible in the judges' times. They were looking to the judges. And when a judge had been given no instruction concerning a successor, they held him responsible and took advantage, and each did what was right in his own eyes again and again. So there was indeed a picture of the government of God with that first lampstand out of the seven of the menorah in the temple. When the congregation was established. And the second represented by the period of judges. But the children of Israel ultimately wanted somebody visible to lead. And we are introduced to a period in which we have one nation, maybe under God, but certainly under a king. Saul, David, and Solomon. Now here it becomes quite clear that there were many problems about God's government in the days of Saul. There were those who thought, well, this can't be true. God wouldn't surely let things deteriorate like this under Saul. He had his enemies, even as he himself had become an enemy of God. There were those who felt the same about David. One of the songs we sang this afternoon is about David's father-in-law. As far as we know, the man, Ahithophel, who gave wise counsel to David, who turned to be a traitor because he ultimately held David responsible for what had happened to his daughter, the wife of Uriah the Hittite. The background of that appears in a nicely presented letter from personal correspondence, if you should like any further information on that. But in this third stage, when there was a king and no longer judges, you can imagine there were people who said, like Samuel began to reason, we can't have kings. We had judges. God had approved judges. How can he approve kings? How can these changes be made? What would you have done? Would you have continued to argue like Samuel? What is going to happen when you have kings and refuse to have one? And join the Moabites, and the Edomites, and the Philistines, the Egyptians, yes, the Arameans, all those wonderful people on the Tigris River, the Assyrians. You think about what it would have been like to move from Moses' day and Joshua's to the time of the judges, or from the time of the judges to the time of kings. And you would have to say, I frankly might not know why God makes his decisions. But if Samuel is right and God has used him, God has told Samuel very clearly, we're now going to allow kings. And that's that. Because after all, this is God's church. This is God's congregation. This is his nation. Now, if you want to join another nation, you will have whatever benefits the gods of those nations will provide. But then, such a remarkable thing happened after Solomon was dead. Rehoboam discovered that 10 of the 12 tribes had revolted, and he set out to stamp out this civil war. And God sends a prophet and says, now, don't do that. You just let most of the church go. Most of the congregation go. Just bring your troops back. Listen carefully. Because this thing is of me. Why, what a statement to make. Kings in the days of Saul and thereafter, God is permitting. Now he's permitting the church to be divided and 10 of the 12 tribes to do what they wanted to do. And not to reunite the nation? There would be people surely in this fourth stage who would say, how can we have any confidence in our administration if the king tells his army, we will allow this civil war that we are starting to be immediately terminated? Why, those tribes up north ought to be a part of the church. Then you read the story, of course, of what happened during the divided monarchy of the 10 tribes in the north of Judah and others who joined with them in the south. And you will notice what a different state of mind generally existed both in the kings in the south, but not always, and most certainly existed in the north. Some were more evil than others. And finally, the kingdom of the north was carried into captivity, and the kingdom of the south continued to the days of the Babylonian power. And they themselves went into captivity, the difference being that Israel was, in a sense, expelled from the land, never asked to return in those days. But Judah was asked to return in a repentant state, something that the children of Israel had never as a whole done. And when they did, they had to leave their nation and become Jews. And now they're coming back after the Babylonian captivity under the Persians. And what do you think is going to happen? Are we going to go back to the government of Moses? Are we going to have judges now and then? Are we going to have kings? Well, after all, the Persians were running the world. And the leader of the Persians was the Shah on Shah, the king of kings. And the prophet had already said that no one would prosper out of the immediate lineage that had been ruling in Judah in the days of Nebuchadnezzar on the throne of Judah. And so now there were governors. Governors of the house of David. Governors in some way who may not have been of the house of David. There were men like Ezra, who was a priest. Nehemiah, who functioned at the court of the King of Kings. You mean that God's government starts with a continuity of judges, then has another period of time when there is no continuity, and then a third period of time in which everybody is together under a king, and a fourth one when the monarchy is divided, and now a fifth period in which we have governors, and above the governor is a Gentile? Can you have faith in a God who allows things like that? Could you say that the government is based on faith? Think about it, because those things are written in this book for us to ask, what would you have done? Would you have decided to revolt and say, there should not be a governor under another nation? We must engage in war. Well, there came a time when the Jews had to make a decision. Josephus tells us about this when the Greeks came on the scene. I won't tell you the background of that because it's not essential here. It's not directly in the Bible. But some remarkable things happened, and Alexander the Great was persuaded to allow the Jews to continue to function as conscientious objectors, to be able to keep the sabbatical year and the jubilee, the tithes, the holy days, the Sabbath, those things that made that nation unique, which the children of Israel in the north had long since abandoned, except for those who were willing to live as Jews. They are now under the Greeks. And we are not told very much of what happened in extra-biblical material in the early part of the Greek period. But you come to a time when indeed the question is one that might have faced John Widener. A Greek, not in the tradition of the open-mindedness of Athens, a Greek in the tradition of Oriental monarchy, decided that there shall be one fundamental respect for religion, and it is to be the manner of the Gentiles. And it was time that the Jews conform for the greater good to the world of the Syrian Greeks. And he had sent his army, and they had taken the temple, and they now must offer swine's flesh to God and offer pig's blood on the altar. And some decided to cooperate because they reasoned, well, this must be what God allows. I know the law doesn't say anything like that should be done, but we might as well compromise. And some of them did, and some did not, the Maccabees. Now here, interestingly, we have decisions to be made. What was your attitude if you had lived then between the days of Moses and Joshua, and then the story of the later elders judges, as to why after one died there was no other for a long time, and until we come to the latter part of the period, which I am not going into at the moment, but those were regional judges. When the kings came, would you have decided that you had to take action or that you recognized God's government? And how would you know? How would you understand Samuel? How would you therefore understand David in that period? Then came the divided monarchy, and how would you have decided that? Or that of the governors? But here, as the governors continued, there arose a crisis the like of which there had been none before. And what would you have said? We have been asked to offer swine's blood. We have been asked not to circumcise our children. In fact, we have been asked not to read the law. We have been asked to become like the Gentiles around us who are being Hellenized. The Maccabeans said no. The Jewish nation was divided. And now we have a line of priests who later became priest kings, of the house of Aaron, not the house of David, who led those people in the nation of Judah who rallied around the law as distinct from those who said, well, God's government surely would permit us to compromise on these points, for why should we die? This question was met by many in World War II. Why should we not, in fact, let the Jews reap what they sow? Let the Marxists reap what they sow? Let the Catholic priests reap what they sow? Let the homosexuals reap what they sow? Let the gypsies reap what they sow? Until the question arises what you do when they come knocking at your door, when it's too late. The Maccabees saw that this was not a time for compromise. This was different. This was not like it was when the Persians treated our governors with respect. This was not like it was when the house of David steered the house of Judah through treacherous waters while the other tribes wandered off into spiritual ignorance. And then there came a later time toward the end of that period when circumstances arose, a seventh period in the government, in which we have the scribes and Pharisees having seated themselves in Moses' seat. And what would you have done if the Galilean rabbi had said, the scribes and Pharisees have seated themselves on Moses' seat? Now what they command you to do, pay respect to them and do it, but don't do after their works, for they're very scrupulous about the law as to what you should do, but they are not with respect to their private lives. Anyway, you could ask yourself, why shouldn't I be an Essene? Why shouldn't I be a Sadducee? Why do I have to listen to this rabbi who allows these people who sat themselves in Moses' seat to tell me what to do? Now, I know I find this rabbi's message interesting. You know, just ask yourself, what would you have done? Would you have joined with the Herodians? Would you have plotted against that rabbi with some Pharisees but not others? Would you have been a zealot, a political party aimed at the overthrow of Roman government over your people? There are questions that happily we don't have to answer because that's of another age, but there are lessons there. John Widener had to make certain decisions in his life. He had to decide whether the spirit of murder or altruism should be the spirit to govern society. Whether loving one's brother was the way to go, even if it might cost you your life. Now, happily, a center has been established in Massachusetts, where John Widener's private papers have been sent. The center is dedicated to the for the cultivation of the altruistic spirit. I did make a telephone call because I very much appreciate what is going to be done there. To have those who can give lectures and who can investigate and come to a better understanding, not of the men and women who did evil, but of those who did good and why, some who have been altogether forgotten and others who have been made heroes or heroines. Just as we have had those periods of government in the Old Testament church, so we have periods in which the work of God varies in time and place and purpose and circumstances. So different in the days of the old Roman Empire from the time when the center of the government of Rome is in Asia Minor. So different when it is centered among a people other than the Greeks or Jews in Armenia, or having many of these people in the time of the rise of Islam forced into migration into Southern Europe in the Balkans, discover ultimately in the Alps people who had been there also for a long time. And finally, wandering into Britain and rediscovering the importance of the Sabbath. Not that it was not altogether unknown, but that it was only known by some and practiced by some on the continent, especially in Italy. But now the Sabbath became very important. But the churches who began to understand the purpose of life and had understood the Sabbath day had great conflict in the days of Queen Elizabeth over the subject of the holy days. And then the church came into a new land, still under the government of Britain, but later to be, interestingly, under a government that separates church and state, that gives certain freedom and also certain responsibility. As a Buddhist doctor in San Marino, in whose home I have been, who had in his guest a Catholic friend of this work from Sri Lanka, said, in corroborating what I mentioned to our mutual Catholic friend, it's one of the great tragedies in this country is that no people has been given such freedom for so long in a written constitution so respected. But the tragedy is we haven't all been able to handle that freedom. We go to one extreme or another. We are not a people gifted by nature to stay in the middle of the road. Now there are others who never are on the middle of the road. Our people wander to the right or to the left in this society. The majority tend to be around the middle. But we have too many who wander in one direction or another, and that's why we have such circumstances in poverty and crime as our Canadian neighbors cannot understand. In this free society, God's work functions differently. And it certainly had to function differently in the critical period of the Civil War. The critical period of World War I and World War II, the Korean War, and Vietnam. But 1994 is a different world. And under Christ, we have another administration. The same as there were different administrations between the 1920s and the 1950s over God's people, or the 1860s. Could you answer the question as correctly as John Widener did when he said, "Oh, now I see your government is based in faith." Faith in Jesus Christ as head of the church. Faith that he is doing the will of God the Father. I could only wish, in a sense, that I could say all this with Mrs. John Widener here. But as someone who also observes the Sabbath somewhere else, she couldn't be here today. You will meet John Widener sometime in your life. And if you don't, I'll introduce him to you. You might remember what you might have done, and the problems that you might have faced if you had to have the same things thrust upon your shoulders as were on his. As I said to the Buddhist doctor when one of our ministers was being honored, Howard Davis, we were discussing the fact that here were people of different religious convictions, a Catholic, a Buddhist, there was myself, and there was a minister of the Church of God being honored among others. In his case, you know the story, the film, it was in the worldwide news with respect to their son. I said, "Why should I be one who would want to cut myself off from you? Just because we may not have yet come to understand everything we need to about the purpose of life. Because the purpose of life is we all ultimately share in what that purpose is. Why shouldn't I want to get to know you now?" And they said, "Well, you know, we never quite thought of it that way. Why should I disdain people who don't know all that we understand? Why should I assume that I know in my office what is best for the Church of God? Can't Christ see clearly what he's doing from up there?" Though I don't normally appear here, I will expect you all to be here next week with Robin Weber and the rest of the ministry. I want to thank church administration for the fact that they didn't know that they had chosen the right weekend, or I would not have addressed this question. I think John Widener would have been happy to meet you at the back door if I had invited him, and this had been other circumstances, to get to know all of you, of whom he had said himself, "I know the Church of God members because they love one another."